Good morning. On today's programme, we'll hear from Tenerife, where a cluster of small earthquakes has been detected below the surface of the volcanic island. And also Syria, we hear about the closure of a notorious detention camp which held tens of thousands of people with alleged links to Islamic State. First, we go to Japan, where a recent snap election saw its first female Prime Minister, Takeuchi Sanai, return to power with a historic parliamentary majority. Yet, despite her clear mandate, restrictions, both foreign and domestic, may limit her political agenda. Brian Gaynor reports.
Asahi is the Japanese term for rising sun. It is used in everything from beer to newspapers. It could also be applied to Takeuchi Sanai, Japan's Prime Minister. Her rise has been both swift and astonishing. Not content with becoming the country's first ever female leader, she called a snap election last month to consolidate her power. The result was a landslide victory, handing the ruling Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP, their largest win in their 71-year history. Ms. Takeuchi's popularity saw them secure a two-thirds supermajority, the first ever, in the lower house of parliament. This allows the LDP to override the upper house, which it does not control. Now, the LDP can enact their political agenda without having to compromise with a belligerent opposition. And it is a particularly nationalist agenda. Increase spending on Japan's military forces, take a more assertive stance towards foreigners, both inside and outside of the country, and, most ambitiously, amend the constitution to alter, or even annul, the famous war-renouncing Article 9. Yet, even a supermajority faces constraints, both internal and external. Foreign first. Japan finds itself caught between a more aggressive China and an increasingly unpredictable United States. Last April, President Trump announced a blanket 25% tariff on all Japanese imports. Fearful of what this would mean for Japan's economy, particularly its car industry, Tokyo rushed to reach a compromise with Washington. A deal was struck, though deal implies some type of parity. In return for reducing the tariff to 15%, Japan will invest over $500 billion in the United States by 2029. What it will invest such a colossal amount of money in is at the subjective discretion of President Trump. In addition, once the initial investment has been paid back, any further returns will be split 90% to 10% between the US and Japan. Some, politely, call such an arrangement lopsided. Others, more bluntly, call it extortionate. The Japanese government calls it the price it must pay to do business with the US, and, just as importantly, to maintain the American military alliance that underpins Japan's security amidst a hostile geopolitical neighborhood. This is particularly the case with China. Throughout her political career, Ms. Takeuchi has been a vocal critic of Japan's formidable neighbor. Her election to prime minister annoyed the Chinese government, but that quickly turned to anger following her remarks on Taiwan. In November, during a parliamentary debate, she implied that Japan could intervene militarily if China attacked Taiwan. The Chinese government demanded she withdraw the remarks and apologize for interfering in what Beijing regards as a domestic matter. Ms. Takeuchi refused, and China retaliated by imposing import restrictions on Japanese foods. It also warned its citizens not to travel to Japan, citing, though without any actual evidence, increased attacks on Chinese tourists in the country. In a further ratcheting up of pressure, China announced restrictions on exports to a targeted list of 20 Japanese companies. Although no details were given, the concern within Japan is that the restrictions will include rare earths, metals that are critical materials for the country's electronic and car industries. Currently, over 70% of such rare metals are imported from China. Even an embargo for a couple of months would have serious repercussions for many Japanese industries. Domestically, her preferred expansionary economic policies are also facing a financial reality check. Along with an electoral pledge to increase spending on defence to 2% of GDP, Ms. Takeuchi also rashly promised to suspend the consumption tax for 2 years. In essence, this means she is planning to increase public spending while simultaneously reducing tax revenues. The only way to square this particular financial circle is to issue more government debt. Given that Japan's public debt is already the equivalent of 247% of its GDP, and that interest rate payments alone are due to double by 2029, means that such government profligacy is untenable. And then there is Japan's accelerating demographic decline. The concurrent reduction in economic growth, projected to be less than 1% this year, means that future tax revenues are also forecast to shrink. In turn, electorally unpopular but necessary decisions on the withdrawal of public services, particularly hospital closures, need to be made. Encouraging immigration to Japan would help mitigate some of these problems, but Ms. Takeuchi's ingrained apathy to foreigners makes that unlikely. Not everything can be solved with a parliamentary supermajority. Tsuyu, another Japanese term, refers to the annual rainy season. Although still a couple of months away, the gathering clouds are already beginning to obscure Ms. Takeuchi's rising sun. For World Report, this is Brian Gaynor in Hokkaido in Japan.
To Tenerife now, where scientists have recently recorded a cluster of small earthquakes several kilometres below the surface of the volcanic island. However, experts stress that while ongoing vigilance is required, there is no sign of any imminent eruption. Cleen O'Flynn has this report.
For those of us of a certain age, the words "don't panic" will ring bells. And at the moment, it certainly seems to be a phrase the Tenerife Tourism Board would like to have printed on their 2026 brochures. It's certainly not too easy a message to sell when publications all over the world, including in Ireland, are running articles about the dangerous and unstable state of our volcano, Mount Teide, and volcanic activity in the seas between the islands. However, as a long-time resident here, not for the first time, I would urge people to actually believe the authorities and ignore the headlines. Of course, it would be foolish to forget that these Canary Islands are volcanic and the volcanoes themselves are dormant, not extinct. The islands were formed by a volcanic hotspot beneath the African plate. As magma rises, it fractures rock, and that fracturing produces volcanic tremors and earthquakes. Not every swarm leads to an eruption, but sustained seismic activity is often a warning sign. Recent examples include the 2021 eruption of the Cumbre Vieja volcano in La Palma. Thousands of small quakes were detected in the weeks before the eruption in September of that year. This was the most significant recent volcanic crisis in the Canaries. The eruption lasted for 6 weeks and, yes, many, many hectares were covered and still are with volcanic lava. But no one was injured and the volcanic experts were monitoring the situation in the lead up to the eruption. In fact, they kept the authorities and media so well informed that local TV station TV Canarias were live on site reporting as the first plumes were spotted. So, yes, there are regular seismic shifts. It is part of living in a volcanic region, but most of us who live here have faith in the volcanic experts, and luckily to date, the politicians do too. Volcanic activity is monitored by the Instituto Geográfico Nacional, the IGN, which tracks earthquake location and depth, ground deformation, gas emissions and thermal changes. In fact, after the 2021 La Palma eruption, monitoring systems were strengthened across the islands. It is true that Tenerife has recently experienced a series of seismic swarms, which are clusters of small earthquakes occurring in the same area over a short period. In February alone, scientists recorded thousands of tiny tremors under the Las Cañadas del Teide area. These events are mostly of very low magnitude and have taken place several kilometres below the surface, generally unnoticed by people living here. Scientists describe this pattern as part of ongoing volcanic activity beneath Tenerife, not an isolated event. Experts say it shows that the underground system is active and that fluids moving in the volcanic hydrothermal system may be causing the tremors. The IGN works together with the volcanic emergency plan known as PEVOLCA. In a recent meeting of the PEVOLCA Scientific Committee, experts confirmed that aside from the seismic swarms, there were no significant changes in ground deformation that might suggest magma is rising quickly towards the surface. Gas emissions have not increased alarmingly, and there's no evidence of increased eruption risk in the short or medium term, meaning weeks to months. However, one spokesperson for the IGN, Ruben Lopez, said that the recent slowdown in activity does not mean the episode was over, emphasizing the need for ongoing vigilance. On the political and civil protection side, local authorities have been proactive in communicating with the public and preparing for any eventuality. Rosa Davila, president of the Cabildo of Tenerife, which is the island government, has repeatedly urged calm and responsible information sharing, noting that scientists do not currently see signs of an imminent eruption. She said authorities are working to raise public awareness about living in a volcanically active region. Officials have faced and countered misinformation online, reminding residents that Tenerife's volcano is among the most closely monitored in the world and urging people to rely only on official sources for updates. Nemesio Perez, scientific coordinator of InVolcan, the Canarian Volcanic Institute, has reiterated that the latest events, in the form of seismic swarms and earthquakes, do not point to an imminent eruption at Teide. The picture we are seeing is that everything being observed, whether seismic swarms or hybrid events, is related to pressurization, he said, on Canaries Radio. Island President Davila does acknowledge public concern over volcanic risk, but says Tenerife is better prepared than a year ago. Teide, she said, is probably the most monitored volcano in the world. Today we have instrumentation sufficient to detect events that would have gone unnoticed 20, 30 or 50 years ago. So no eruption is expected in the coming months. And given that the constant activity in the region ensures that our volcanic scientists gain unparalleled practical experience, making them leading figures in modern rapid response volcanology, the rest of us can sleep more easily. For World Report, this is Cleanne O'Flynn in Tenerife.
Next to Syria, where a notorious detention camp, which once held tens of thousands of people, including families with alleged links to ISIS, has closed. Last month, Syria's government took control of the camp as Damascus extended its reach across northeastern Syria. The camp has long been condemned by human rights organisations, as those who were detained there never were charged or faced any trial, as Sally Hayden reports.
We watch as they descend from the buses. The elderly, small children, women and a few men. Some have disabilities, some are clearly traumatised. They look around confused. They are not used to seeing any new environment. These few hundred people are what is left of the more than 200,000 who until recently resided in a notorious detention camp known as Al-Hol. Most were accused of affiliation with the so-called Islamic State or ISIS, which controlled huge stretches of this region a decade ago, while provoking terror across the world through attacks and violent propaganda. These detainees were separate to the thousands of men who languished in prisons, but all of them were in the semi-autonomous northeast of Syria. Until January, this area was controlled by Kurdish-led authorities backed by the US. Those in the camps were widely believed to be ISIS family members, though many said they were simply civilians caught up in the chaos of war. Medical charity MSF described Al-Hol as a massive outdoor prison. The camp's existence was condemned by human rights organisations, who pointed out that those there were never charged or faced any trial. They included children, now trapped in a situation which many worried could only radicalise people further. Residents of around 43 nationalities were in Al-Hol. More than 2,000 others, including some of the more notorious Westerners, are still in another Kurdish-controlled camp called Raj. Last year, I visited Al-Hol, right after US aid cuts sparked chaos among residents. There, I met Jihan Hanan, one of the camp's two head managers. She asked why more countries had not repatriated their nationals, instead leaving them for Syrians to deal with. Jihan fled Al-Hol this year, when the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces withdrew, following the breakdown of an agreement between them and the central Syrian government, who want to see the whole country unified. Weeks later, Jihan WhatsApped me to say she heard the camp was empty, that everyone escaped. The exact ramifications of this have yet to be fully understood. It came as the US announced that Syria's central government, led by President Ahmed al-Sharaa, is where the future lies. Sharaa himself was once jihadi and the head of al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate, but says he has left that past behind. Now ISIS threatens him, calling his government secular. Since the government's military advance, more than 5,700 prisoners accused of being ISIS members have been transferred from Syria to Iraq, where lawyers say there are human rights concerns about the risk of torture and other abuses. Some of Al-Hol's residents have been moved to a new camp in Aleppo governorate, where they will live in prefabricated shelters dependent once again on humanitarian aid. I spoke to some after they arrived. They said they are not monsters and should not be treated like such. They worried about their children's futures and said they longed to see their extended families. Other Al-Hol residents went home much faster. In the city of Manbij, I met a man who only wanted to be identified by his first name. Fadi worked as a pharmacist in Raqqa during the time of ISIS, just one of many civilians unable to oppose this dangerous group, he says. He was injured in a bombing and tried to flee with his wife. He says soldiers from the International Coalition told him he only needed to go to Al-Hol briefly and would be allowed to leave quickly as he had done no wrong. 2 to 3 months lasted for 8 years, he said. I asked a coalition spokesperson for comment, but he did not respond. Fadi says he reckons around 20% of Al-Hol's residents had what he called an extremist mentality, and the lack of differentiation between those people and everyone else was the reason they were all locked up for so long. Days after government forces took over, he says, detainees were told that they could either wait for organizations to slowly move them with their belongings, or they could leave straight away with nothing. In the end, what did I have? A tent? My freedom is what I want, he said. Fadi opted to leave as soon as possible. His family and another packed into one military vehicle, he says, and they were given a lift to Aleppo, managing the final part of the journey themselves. 3 of his 4 children were born in Al-Hol. Imagine, says Fadi, they didn't know what an apartment building or house or car was. They only saw UN cars. They didn't know what a tree was because the camp was in a desert. For World Report, this is Sally Hayden in Syria.
That's it from World Report for today. This morning's programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or find us on all platforms. We'll be back at the same time next week. Until then, from me, Paul Cunningham, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.